And welcome again to another episode of A Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast. My name is Michael Bates.
I'm Dave Douglas.
And we are very happy to be back.
Thanks for joining us. As you know, you can always reach us at podcast@greenleafmusic.com. And today we're talking to
John O'Gallagher, great saxophone player, composer from Brooklyn. And I think we're going to, Meshuggah's going to make an appearance possibly.
That's right. We'll be talking to Drummond too.
And Drummond. We're going to get to some listener mail. And, you know, if you, for those of you who are out there that are fans of Dave Douglas's, he is on the cover of Downbeat, or was on the cover of the Downbeat for the month of June. So we're going to get to that. But first, let's talk to John O'Gallagher.
Hey John, it's Dave Douglas calling from Greenleaf Music.
Hey Dave, how are you?
Good, glad you could be with us.
Oh, thanks for calling.
Well, you know Michael Bates is here too.
I am.
Oh, Michael, how you doing?
Good, how you doing, John?
Good.
All right.
So we're going to do some A Noise from the Deep, Webern and your music and your book and all of that and beyond.
Great, well, I appreciate you calling and having me.
Okay, so you have this incredible new record out that I heard maybe, you know, about a month ago, and it really knocked me out. One of the things that you say in the liner notes that I found kind of fascinating is that you mentioned that even educated listeners have some kind of preconception about Webern's music, which is sort of serialist 12-tone music, and one of your goals was to present his music as clearly and as beautifully as possible, and that fascinated me.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just think that, you know, Webern has always been, you know, kind of categorized as being the guy that's hard to listen to and very dissonant and very heady.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, in his music to me, I mean, you know, it's very complex and it's coming from a very technical place, but I always felt like it had a lot of warmth and a lot of heart and a lot of real kind of earthiness in a way, for as, you know, technical as you could, you know, analyze it. And I felt like a lot of times people, maybe their impression of Webern is, you know, probably based on just a few instances of, you know, maybe a few selected pieces. It'd be like somebody listening to, you know, Interstellar Space, you know, Coltrane, and getting an idea of like thinking that, well, you know, his music is just that, and that's all there is to it. But
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a lot more than that.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. So with this project, you know, I've always felt like there were, you know, there was a lot of melodic, beautiful melodies in his music, and I wanted to, you know, try and present those, and also the pieces that I selected, I thought, you know, out of, you know, a lot of his work, you know, were very tuneful and had like a really kind of very much of a song quality. So that was kind of one of the determining factors in the music that I selected.
But, you know, a lot of Webern, the other thing that he gets characterized is that so many of his pieces are so short. Like,
right.
the pieces are very brief, and he goes through, as you were saying, yeah, very beautiful melodies and unusual shapes and a lot of pathos and emotion, but all very, very tightly packed. So
yeah.
I was wondering, like, what pieces of his would you take as an example of what you're talking about?
Well, The pieces that I selected, you know, I mean, I think are really representative of the things that to me felt like they were really, you know, with Webern, it seems like a lot of, you know, it could be broken down into his pieces that are kind of song-like, you know, and he obviously wrote a lot of songs, you know, for voice and piano and voice and small chamber groups and things like that. But, and then there are other pieces where they're, in my mind, they're almost, almost like, you know, an improviser, you know, when we're improvising, he's taking these ideas and then kind of running with them. And even though they're highly, you know, really rigorous and constructed with really concentrated, you know, elements, they seem to be kind of almost, you know, a little more, you know, kind of through composed in a way, even though, you know, that's probably the wrong word to use. But the forms don't necessarily jump out at you. In the same way that some other compositions do. So, you know, I think that, like, you know, the last piece that he wrote, which was Opus 31, which we recorded, you know, that to me, you know, when I first heard that, I just thought, wow, you know, this is not something that I don't think most people would typically think of as Webern. If you played it for them, it's such a short piece, but it's really, you know, it's a beautiful chorale that is not the typical kind of, you know, cliched impression that people have of Webern as being very pointillistic and very, you know, lots of jumps in octaves and major sevenths and minor ninths and all these kind of things.
Is the music that you're presenting here, is this something that you're doing it more for you? Who are you trying to reach as an audience?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, obviously, I did it because, first and foremost, of my you know, creative curiosity and wanting to see, you know, what can be done with this and loving this music for a long time. But I think that there's an audience for this. You know, people... you know, I think that as famous as Webern might be in our minds, you know, that's pretty fairly unknown to the vast majority
right.
of the public. So,
yeah.
So, you know, there's an opportunity in a way for people who maybe don't know his music or have heard the word, you know, to maybe enter it through kind of, you know, modern jazz context.
Yeah, it's interesting because I recorded a short arrangement of Webern on my first album. And
you know, I remember that, actually. I forget which piece you did.
Well, it was from the string quartet.
Okay.
And it was just one of the movements, and it's very short, and it opens the record. And my thinking in doing it was, like, this belongs in jazz. You know, it sounds improvised already, so let's take the motives and run with them a little bit. I felt like if we ran with them too far, you know, it sort of defeated the purpose of having this highly compact language. But, but I just wonder, you know, and then I was kind of surprised by the reaction being, you know, well, Webern doesn't belong in jazz and you really shouldn't have done that. From a lot of quarters. I mean, that was a lot of years ago, but.
Yeah, but still, that is surprising.
You know, one of the reasons I wanted to do it was because I felt like the language in those melodies and in the rows and in the shapes seemed so suited to having improvisers work with it. And
absolutely.
So you that's kind of where you're coming from with it as well.
Very, very much. I think that, you know, and you know, as you guys know, that you know, the language of modern jazz, you know, improvisation and composition is really, you know, well, it's always drawn on classical music as you know, as an inspiration and to inform it and to, you know, for jazz to be developed in new ways by drawing on it. And I think that especially in today, that so much of new music that's being created is really synthesizing those things that have come from contemporary classical, and especially, you know, the ideas from set theory and, you know, dealing with, you know, serial composition, you know, not only just necessarily organization of pitch, but rhythm as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, things like that, that are really have made a lot of headway and really synthesized with jazz today. And for me, you know, the sounds that we hear when we listen to, like Webern, so much of that language is the type of sounds that we're familiar with that we use when we play all the time, because they, you know, very much deal with symmetric kind of constructions and things that, you know, imply sounds from whole tone or symmetric augmented or diminished or dividing octave, you know, in tritones and then different ways of doing that. And it's like all these sounds that as improvisers we, you know, work on and try and, you know, understand and apply in our music. So it just seems to me like it's not, you know, an alien kind of landscape. It's really integrated in what we do. As far as improvising too, you know, I mean, we think so much in terms of motives and developing ideas, and that's what that music is based on.
Absolutely.
You know? Yeah. So do you feel like bringing improvisation into those pieces is central to your project?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Like, yeah, have you ever played these pieces, you know, in the original context?
No, I haven't. Mm-hmm. I haven't. I would, you know. That would be really very cool.
And what about doing some of these kinds of arrangements for the original instrumentation? I mean, I guess I'm just sort of running through.
That'd be a great idea.
Ideas.
Wow, that would be fantastic.
I just wonder if you'd ever done
That's great. That's actually, it's funny because I chose like the instrumentation for this project because I want, you know, number one, I wanted to kind of make a stark kind of a division between, you know, the instruments that are originally used in the music, and by using like organ and Rhodes and vibraphone and electric guitar, you know, creating kind of this kind of dividing line in a sonic way between the original and what we're doing. And so, you know, that was obviously intentional, and also by choosing those instruments, being able to orchestrate and deal with, you know, the color aspect of his music, which is such a huge part of it, you know, his orchestrations and you know, having these instruments where I could treat, you know, organ or vibes as basically just a single line solo instrument, or deal with it, you know, in terms of, you know, playing harmony. And so it, you know, gave me a lot of options in order to be able to kind of realize the music in a way I wanted to.
Now, the way that you describe improvising with 12-tone language in the book, is that mm-hmm. something that the people in your band need to know? Like, do you make them spend a year studying your book before they can play in the band?
No, not at all. It's the kind of thing that I've discussed with, a few of them on different occasions, but I didn't want it to be like, the people that I enjoy playing with, I enjoy playing with because they have their own personal vocabulary, and what they bring to it, and that's really, why you choose the people you play with. So I didn't want it to kind of impose any ideas as far as what they were supposed to play. One of the pieces does, a couple of the pieces do deal with, instead of a set of chord changes, I have a set of tri-chord sets that are there for accompaniment, and so people can draw on those pitch sets, but they can play outside of that too, and it doesn't matter. And in reality, a lot of those sets that I set up were kind of tonal in their quality, so that if you wish to, you could treat it as like major 7 sharp 11 chord in a way with some missing pitches or whatever. But I wanted to, at least for the accompanist's sake, to leave it kind of more ambiguous and more open and dealing with just the intervals with the sets, and the soloists can kind of deal with it the way that they would want to, So.
It's really challenging to play, the music,
Oh yeah.
the just the material, the written material itself, but then when you add on the hurdle of improvising with the language, it's pretty
Yeah, this can be very daunting, because you all of a sudden stop using your intuitive self and you start using your intellect, and that can definitely make things a lot more stale in a way, and you don't feel connected to the music as well. And so it's the process of internalizing it that I think is really, once that happens, you're able to access the music in a way that feels more organic, But yeah, I mean, it's the kind of thing that I, for myself, it's the way that I kind of approach things or think. But I've been working on it for, 10, 13 years or something like that, so it's a little easier.
I would be interested in doing in this interview a compare and contrast kind of mashup of the original, playing the original, and then playing the version that you guys did on the record. And I'm kind of leaning towards doing the secret code because of where that ends up. It's like a whole different animal in the middle of that tune with the organ and the groove. Could you talk about that tune and what you did in terms of the arrangement?
Well, that piece is the second movement of Webern's Opus 28, and it's a string quartet piece. And it starts off, basically it's a canon, and the tone row that Webern uses is actually kind of an ode to, he uses a Bach motive, which is kind of common with him and Schoenberg. They would do that a lot, and so that's what the secret code is Bach. But anyway, that piece starts off, with the strings playing pizzicato, and this theme is played, and there's a little ritardando that happens towards the end of the first theme, and then it goes into, after repeating that, it goes into a second section. most of this music, I would create condensed scores of all the pieces so that I could actually look at the piece and be able to, you know, see it as you know, purely, you know, melodic content and harmonic content and where that, those kind of things. And with Webern, there's very little vertical harmony. A lot of times it's almost everything is contrapuntal. And, you know, when there is vertical harmony, it's rarely is it more than three pitches. So, you know, to develop the solo section for this piece, I ended up going and taking one of the, I'm not sure if it was a cello part or not, but I'd have to look at my notes, but one of the parts I extracted and used that as basically like a bass line.
Right, right.
And then we set up a form for that and improvised over that. I changed a few things here and there as far as, you know, rhythmic elements and, you know, reorchestrating and kind of moving octaves here and there, because so often with this music, the registers, you know, would jump around so much that, you know, I couldn't play it because it would be out of my range, or, you know, so there's places where I used, you know, kind of massage the octaves a little bit, but...
And so the language that you're using comes from his rows, which, as you said at the beginning, are based on this B-A-C-H motif.
Exactly.
H being a B-flat in the B-flat. German solfège, right. I guess, system.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So just to shift gears for a second, in your book... You know,
which is called, by the way, just for people out there, it's called 12-Tone Improvisation, A Method for Using Tone Rows in Jazz. It's on Advanced Music.
And you probably have spoken with Dave Liebman at length about all of this, right?
A little bit. Not as actually been intending to get together with him. We've been talking via email a little more. But not so much, but yeah.
You could see it as an outgrowth of his book on chromatic improvisation.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't read his book in many years. I remember when it first came out, I got a copy of it. But the stuff the way that I organize my book was all basically just taken from things in post-tonal theory and set theory, and the way that they view organizing sets according to the trichord structure, and then the 12-tone rows that each one of those trichord structures can create. Because, you know, in diatonic music, we have, you know, major, minor, augmented, diminished, which are our primary, you know, fundamental harmonic units, and they're, those only represent three set classes that are possible out of the 12. So basically in set theory, you know, they deal with like all the properties of, you know, basically every way of grouping pitches from, you know, dyads to 10, 11, you know, 11 notes. So, you know, with this, it seemed to me that it was something that jazz musicians can readily use, because we need some way of organizing things that's not overwhelming, but yet provides a system of you know, harmony that we can use melodically or harmonically. So with this way of organizing, it seemed to me that this was perfectly suited towards the way jazz musicians work. And as well, you know, each one of these rows and each one of these set classes reflects sounds that we play all the time in jazz. You know, it's whole tone or diminished or augmented, or even, you know, you can even find a major scale, you know, in one of the set classes.
Right.
So it's, So it's basically, I think of it as being kind of the periodic table of music. It's like the most fundamental element of music is going to be three pitches as far as harmonic unit. And this basically represents all of those possibilities. Now with the book, obviously, I use the 12-tone row as being kind of the premise of organizing it. But in fact, you don't have to use a 12-tone row. I mean, I think I say in the first bit, that exploration of, it's kind of to take these ideas and then explore them in non-12-tone ways is really important. And, you listen to Coltrane, and, like, I was actually, doing some work on another book for, like, a second book follow-up. And Coltrane, using, like, tricord 1 plus 2, what's the tune? I think it's Venus, in fourths, and it's taking that set class 1 plus 2, but using it in fourths, and then running through different whole tone cycles of that. And so it's a lot more than just, playing in 12 tones. Uninitiated, that to deal with a harmonic palette that each 12-tone row provides is really useful, and that it's kind of like it's a good jumping-off point,
And you're using it to generate vocabulary for your own playing. And then, I guess one thing I would be curious about is whether you, when you're generating this vocabulary, whether you also find yourself applying it to other situations where, well, you could say where it doesn't belong, or you could say where it creates some interesting juxtapositions.
Which is,
say.
One of the questions that I had written down was, can this way of playing be applied to, like, say, a blues?
Oh, totally. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the thing with this is that, you go through and you look at each one of these, and it's funny because different rows and different tricords to me kind of, like, sound like different things, Like tricord 2 plus 4 to me is like the monk row, because it's really got the whole step and the tritone. And when you start messing around with each one of these, different combinations, the book basically deals with taking the four different one tricords that exist in a row and looking at the permutations of two tricords together and what they do harmonically. So, on a blues, there's lots of applications that you can use either doing, single tricord, two tricords extracted from a row, or dealing with, four tricords. And normally, depending on what the structure is that you're dealing with, normally they'll function in a way where two tricords are functional on the chord using chord tones or tensions, and then the other two tricords can be used as dissonance, And some of them actually, though, have instances where three out of the four tricords in 12-tone row will work functionally on a set of chains.
Right. Yeah.
So it just depends on what the structure you're doing, and how you want to manipulate it. And it can be as out as you want, or it can be as in as you want. That's the beauty of it. It's like it's not just one thing.
So you ever work with younger musicians, like feeding them some of this stuff?
No, I haven't. I mean, that's actually something that I've been thinking about, just getting together and workshopping some of this stuff with musicians who are, interested in it, But, yeah, I haven't done it yet.
Well, I'm not that much younger, but I was wondering if I could come over maybe next week or something.
Sure.
Would that be okay?
Okay. Yeah, I'd love
because,
to.
And I'm not that much older, but if I could come too,
yeah,
that would be
and
really
I'm just,
nice.
I've been working on this blues scale thing, and it's been pretty good so far, but this
yeah,
sounds all good. So, okay. John, thank you so much. This music is amazing. I love this record. The book, in the week that I've had it, has scared the pants out of me, but, it's incredible.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, it's been great talking with you guys.
Well, it's great talking to you too. And, I some of the work that I did in this 12-tone direction, a lot of the ideas came from the Charles Warrenen book, Simple Composition.
Oh, that's a great book.
Yeah, you've seen that too, and it's interesting how you've sort of, I don't want to say taken the next step, but, you know, made the context appropriate to improvisers and developing a language harmonically and melodically that way. And so it's really inspiring. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
All right.
Okay, you guys take care.
We'll see you soon. Bye.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Great, John O'Gallagher. Nice music.
Amazing
nice
musical
thinking.
Mind, for sure.
And it made me think of this question that I got recently. So this is kind of coming from the listener mail basket of things. Somebody asked me, what are you thinking when you play out?
Makes sense.
Well, I wish that I'd ask John O'Gallagher that, because he's thinking a lot of things, apparently.
Yeah.
But, you know, it just, I'd be curious to hear what everybody thinks about this and get some insight to it. Because I think, first of all, you know, playing out means different things to different people.
For sure.
One person's out is another person's in, and vice versa. So there's that. But I also feel like, you know, when you hear an improviser, I don't think there's any fine line between somebody playing in and somebody playing out. I think that people are who they are, and so you play from your personality and your personal experience and what you have to play. And I guess as you go about developing a language and developing a vocabulary over the years, you keep adding on new things to play, and some of them are more or less dissonant than others. But there's not like a disconnection where suddenly, at least speaking for myself, where suddenly I would say, okay, now I'm going to play something really out.
Right.
You know, every idea is somehow connected to what's happening in the melody or the structure or the chords or the form. Or everybody that we've had on the podcast that we've interviewed has some
element,
sort of idea about where they're developing what they play and where it's going.
Do you think that that's the nature of that question? Was this a student that asked this question?
Yeah, it was a really good trumpet playing student that was curious. And I think, you know, I think when you hear a new player do things you've never heard before, you know, it's sort of like, what's that famous quote about the definition of a technology that we do not understand is magic? Something like that.
Yeah.
I think it's Clark, Arthur C. Clark. I think I should look that up. Well, we'll call Drummond and ask him.
Let's call Drummond.
But I feel like it's, you know, whatever player you want to mention, whether it's Joe Henderson or Wayne Shorter or Jimmy Lyons or Lester Bowie or Woody Shaw, or, you know, it's not a matter of, it's a matter of extending the vocabulary and the language of the music so that you have something new and different and interesting to say in the music. And it's not about whether something's in or out. That would be my answer to it. We're going to listen to a little bit of Meshuggah and talk about it. And this came up for me because I was listening to and playing with a young drummer who was, you know, working on his swing time feel, and it was not that great. And then suddenly we're playing something with more of a backbeat and a straight eighth note groove. And he had these ferocious chops and all these ideas. So I was like, you know, what are you really listening to? What are you into? And he was like, sort of ashamed, but he was like, well, I really like Meshuggah. I was like, well, don't be ashamed. You know,
yeah,
Meshuggah's great.
Music.
So here's a little bit of that.
and from an album entitled Obzen. That is one of the great metal bands, Meshuggah.
You want to play something else?
We could.
Do you know what the time signatures are and all that kind of stuff?
Well, I think, especially in that last piece that we heard, that it's almost like it's an expanding and contracting rhythmic cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
not unlike like a Messiaen kind of thing.
Hmm.
And that's the appeal of that band to a lot of musicians who want to play sort of more sophisticated music in a way. That Meshuggah is really dealing with stuff that is pretty intense.
I'm going to play something else.
You know, I think our friend Drummond saw Meshuggah.
Let's call him.
Let's call him.
All right. We're calling Drummond.
Hey, what's up?
It's Dave, and Michael's here too.
Hey, Drummond.
Yeah.
So listen, we want to get a man on the street report because we were talking about Meshuggah, and I know you went to a Meshuggah show recently. What was that like?
Yeah, it was fun. I went with a couple friends, and the whole show I was pinned up against the very front of the wall. I couldn't move at all. But the music, the whole time, the singer had been sick for the entire tour, and
like he wasn't singing.
No, yeah, he wasn't singing. So the rest of the shows got a cardboard cutout of him, and we were the last show. And so everyone was expecting him to come out. And the first few songs, he didn't come out. So we just thought we'd, like, oh, well, too bad. He's not going to sing. But then afterwards, he came on out. And, of course, then that's, like, when the mosh pits started getting really insane. And I couldn't even see them. But some of my friends came out with bloody noses, which, you know,
that can't be fun.
Bloody noses?
Yeah.
From headbanging or?
No, from the mosh pits, just the fighting circles.
I see. That's fascinating.
Yeah, I used to be a part of those things.
That happens at my gigs all the time.
I've seen it. As a matter of fact, I've started them.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks, Drummond. That's great.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
Later.
Bye.
Thank you.
Great. So to close out this episode 9.
Wait.
Sorry.
You know, I'd like to just say congratulations for making the cover of Downbeat.
Thank you.
June issue.
Thank you
kind of
so
look.
Much.
You look eerily familiar to someone else. It might be the glasses. The
George Colligan.
Don't think that's who I was thinking about.
Is it Alex Gibney?
No, I think it like.
Oh, I know. It's
Joe Lovano.
Joe Lovano. I wish.
Sort of circa Landmark.
That would be nice.
Landmark's era.
Yeah, yeah.
Joe Lovano. Well,
we love Joe.
Nice cover.
We love Joe here at the podcast.
Yes, we do.
So, anyway, speaking of the Downbeat cover, there was a lot of good stuff in there. It was like transcribed from a talk that I was giving, and I'm really grateful that they gave me the coverage and the freedom to speak at length. I left out so many people that I should have thanked. So
it's okay,
I'm
going to
just wait. Not you and not Drummond either. So no, you guys. No. Yeah, definitely you and Drummond. But my sister Susan, first among them,
right?
Because she was when I was very little. She's a little bit older than me. She played flute,
mm-hmm.
and she had some Music Minus One records around the house.
Oh, wow.
And one of them was a record that Mal Waldron made of Music Minus One. This is sort of before the Jamie Abersol era. So it was. I didn't know how to read, and I didn't know what was in the booklet, and there were all these instructions, but I would just sort of drop the needle and try to play along, figure out what key it was and figure out what was the right thing to play. And it was when I later learned who Mal Waldron was and heard some of his records and heard the way he played, it was like they really captured him on that Wow. Record. I wish I still had it, but you know, it was my sister Susan that made that appear in our house. So thanks, and thanks to Mel Waldron, thanks to John McNeil, who I don't think I mentioned in the article, and he was a really, really important teacher for me at New England Conservatory. And then I still hang out with him now, and we're trying to get him on the podcast as well. Andy Bay is somebody who, during that period I was with Horace Silver, he was also with the band. And,
oh, yeah?
Yeah, and it was we did some sessions on the side. He's also a great piano player. And I did a project with him a few years ago.
Yeah, I saw it at the Vanguard.
The Vanguard. Yeah. And so, but he was really someone that influenced me a lot in the way that he would phrase melodies, the way he was thinking about presenting the music, and just his approach to being in that band was really something. I don't think I mentioned Jim McNeely, who I studied with at NYU, and, you know, who showed me a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And that I think I was soaking up a lot of stuff that he was just, you know, learning by example more than even things that he was saying. And I've had the chance recently to work with him again. And, you know, he's just such a wonderful composer, arranger, pianist. I want to say thank you to him, too, as well as to all the people who've played in my bands over the years. And it's people too numerous to mention.
Yeah,
here,
yeah,
but,
yeah.
So, anyway.
I'd be very interested in hearing some Jim McNeely music, and I do believe that we have in the Greenleaf A Noise from the Deep podcast library, we have your album Single Sky, A Single Sky, so we'll play something with that going out. Before we do that, I would like to remind you that you can write us here at A Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast, at podcast@greenleafmusic.com. And also, if you like what we do here, please do stop past the iTunes store and leave a comment. Let us know. So I'm Michael Bates. This is Dave Douglas. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks.